if we could have the screen down, please, now. Thank you. Get all organized up here. Gotta do that crazy baptism thing. Throws everything off. Terrible, terrible, terrible. Wonderful thing. Wonderful thing to see someone do such a public profession of their faith in that way. And I hope everyone gets it. I hope everyone's got it. I hope everyone understands that we are buried with him spiritually and we are raised to new life, which is a spiritual life. And the baptismal waters is a beautiful picture of that truth. We're still in the book of Hebrews. As you know, this will be my penultimate Sunday here. If you don't know the word penultimate, look it up. Just kidding. Next to the last, obviously, is what it is. And so I didn't learn the word penultimate until I learned Portuguese. And that was a normal word in Portuguese, but I didn't know it in English until then. So when you learn other languages, sometimes you find out there's more out there than you knew. Quite a few things like that. So we've been going through the book of Hebrews, and of course we have not been exhausting the book in any way. We have not gone verse by verse and taken every bit of the teaching out of it that we possibly could. But as I came to the realization of when I would be leaving, and we had just begun the book of Hebrews, and I looked at it and I said, I don't want to leave things, you know, right in the middle either too much if possible. So I decided to go ahead and just kind of hit some highlights as we've gone through some of the major thoughts that come up. And it's been a very interesting study as I've developed it, that I believe that it has been appropriate to the time of my leaving and the things that you'll be coming into in the future. Last week, of course, we were in that beautiful, beautiful chapter, one of the most, one of the most encouraging and stirring and also at the same time challenging chapters in the entire Bible, the book of the chapter 11, which has been called by many the Hall of Faith of the Bible. By faith, Enoch, by faith, Abraham, by faith, Moses, down through the line. And as we saw last week, by faith, we saw the faith of some people that we might not think of as warriors of faith on our own. Gideon, for example, who was hiding during the threshing time when God came to him and said, I've got a job for you to rise up against the Midianites. And he did it sort of like Moses, sort of a thing, like, who am I? I'm nobody. I'm the least. And we understand that when you're what he was doing was winnowing wheat, threshing wheat. You throw it up into the air, right? And you want the chaff to blow away and just the seeds to come to the ground. Well, he was down in a valley doing that. Not a good sign. If he'd been up on a hilltop, that would have been normal. But he was obviously hiding from this Midianite threat. And God came to him. I believe we have a lot of lessons we can take out of that. I think sometimes all of us, and maybe some of us more than others, who knows, are hiding from the idea of serving God because we're afraid that it would just be too much for us. And it is. It absolutely is. But God. Always but God. When he calls us into something, I like to put it this way. This is just something I say, and I may not be the only one that's ever said it, but God does not call the gifted. He gifts the called. So when God calls you to do something, he will give you what you need to be able to do that. And in chapter 11, then we saw that in some very unusual people, Rahab, a harlot, God used in the saving of the city of Jericho and in the continuation of that which God would do through Israel. And then we found Samson, of course, that up and down, I think we can relate a lot to him, you know, in some ways. Maybe not to those extremes again, but he was on and he was off and he was up and he was down and he believed and he doubted. And you just see your own human nature in him a lot of times. Again, his was extreme. And God still used him in some pretty interesting and obviously important ways. And he's mentioned then. To me, it's kind of amazing that someone like that would be mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11, but there he is. That gives me comfort, that gives me encouragement, that God can use me. God can use me in spite of myself. If you ever get beyond that thought, you're probably useless. I'm just going to tell you right now. If you ever get to the point where you think that you've arrived and that you can do all of it yourself, and God, whatever you want to throw at me, that's fine. If you ever stop depending on God for every part of your life, you're going to fail in some ways that are just going to make you miserable and are just going to cause you all kinds of difficulties. Let me say this, and I hope nobody takes it the wrong way at all. I always appreciate it when people talk nice about me. I mean, that's, everybody likes that. And you're going to throw me a little shindig back here today, and I really, really do appreciate that. And some of you may even have some kind words for me. That's fine, whatever. If you don't, just keep your mouth shut, right? Like my old grandma used to say, if you can't say something nice, don't say nothing at all. I know everybody here is kind. I'm just playing with you there. But I hope you do understand that nobody is so important that God needs them and can't do what he wants to do without them. God forbid, interesting way to put it, I guess, God forbid that God should need me, because he would be in bad shape. If you have something good to say about me, if there's something that you like about me, if you've enjoyed something about me being your pastor, wonderful. Believe me, it all comes from God, and I'm not saying that just to be a phony baloney about it. I mean it with all my heart. I have nothing within me. It's only as God gifts me and allows me to do anything in my life. You know the circumstances, of course, of the last few years of my life, and it has taught me tremendous lessons. I never would have asked to go through what I've gone through. I remember thinking many times, preaching and teaching many times about how Christians many times have to suffer. And we talked this morning about folks in Myanmar, folks in India, people all over the world who suffer for their faith. And I used to sort of kind of feel maybe a little bad that I must not have enough faith, or I must not be as useful to God as I should be, because I never felt like I went through a trial at all. In my estimation, I lived a blessed life, and I still do. But I lived such a blessed life that those kinds of trials that I thought were beyond, you know, my experience, that must be for other people. It must be for those saints who are just really sold out to the Lord and willing to sacrifice everything. We're going to see a little bit about that in today's message, that concept. As I've gone through what I have gone through, and you don't know everything I've gone through, and I don't tell everybody everything that I've gone through, and that's okay. I'm not here to get your pity or anything this morning, but for the 4 years that my wife had cancer, there were so many other tumultuous things going on you can't even begin to imagine. And the people that I do confide into that level and talk to about some of those details just stare at me sometimes and say, how can you do that? And I've had some say, oh, you must be a super Christian. Like, no, that's not it. There's nothing in me to go through those things. There's no way that I marvel myself, not at myself. I just marvel at the fact that I can still stand up and that I could come back into the church weekly and I could come in here and do this function. It was every day I would marvel at the grace of God that kept me going and keeps me going. So I want you to understand that as we look into chapter 12 today, too, that this idea that we have so many times of these great heroes of the faith, we get mixed up. It's great to have great faith. It's great to have any faith. As Jesus said, if you just have a little bit, you know, the grain of a mustard seed, then you can do great things. But it's not you that'll do it. We understand that, because the faith in itself is not what's important. It's important. But what's important is that our faith is in the right person. And we have this belief, this trust, this confidence that he will do whatever has to be done. So therefore, if you plug in one person here and they go, and you plug another person into that spot, and this one comes and that one goes, that's okay. Because in the final analysis, it's God. It's not me, it's not you, it's not any of us, it's God. And so our faith comes in when we say, God will do this, he might have a place for me in it, let me be a Gideon who will finally, reluctantly maybe, but will finally say, all right, Lord, I'll do what you say. And see God do some great things, miraculous things. I've seen miraculous things during my time here at this church. We witnessed one of them this morning, the open testimony of someone who made a profession of faith in Christ before he came here, but has become such a part of us already. Isn't that an amazing thing, how the people come in here, and we didn't know either one of these people as they came in. We never met them before they walked in the doors here, none of us. And yet here they are, just absolutely as much a part of us as anybody else could be. And that's just the way it works. And it's God. It is strictly and completely 100% God that does that. So looking at chapter 11 and the idea of faith, we need to understand what faith is and what faith isn't. And I make the statement, it might sound a little crazy. Not me, I never do that, of course. But might sound a little crazy, but we're talking about Jesus is better, the theme of Hebrews. The entire book, we've used the theme which runs through the book clearly. Jesus is better. Well, in chapter 11, Jesus is better than faith. Now, faith in Jesus is what we need. But Jesus himself is better than any kind of strength of faith that we can work up in ourselves and say, look at me, I have all this faith. If you have faith, it's because God has given it to you and blessed you and allowed you to be in his work. Look at chapter 12 now as we come out of that. Verse number 1 of chapter 12 says, wherefore, seeing we are also compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Couldn't we just camp here for a while on this verse? What a profound verse. We see the examples in chapter 11, and this is what he no doubt is referring to when he talks about this great cloud of witnesses. That which God accomplished through those people simply because they believed what he said. Simply because they accepted the challenges that he gave them, saying, I will be with you. I will be the strength of this. I will do this through you. Simply because of that, they became this great cloud of witnesses. And you probably know people that you lift up in your mind as great examples of people who followed God and believed God. And if you don't know any personally, find you some good books about some people like that. But don't lift them up too high, right? But see what happened. See what God did through them. And then you'll be encouraged to when God does prompt your heart about something, you'll be so much more encouraged to do that. And what does he say here that we need to lay some things aside based on this? In other words, looking back at their example too, what was it that allowed them to be used of God? What was it that actually happened? Did they all of a sudden grow this huge spirituality and became these super Christians? As we've already mentioned, some of them really never got to any level that we would consider that. But yet God used them in great ways. Because, first of all, he said that they, or we should at least, lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us. Now, we could talk about besetting sins, certain sins that come back and come back and come back to us, and probably we all have certain pet sins, things that we just deal with, seems like continuously, and we just have such a hard time letting them go. But this is really much more generalized. It's just the fact that it's a very simple formula here that we need to lay aside this weight, which he uses here as a picture, and the sin. It's really all wrapped in together. The weight of unbelief, I really believe, is the sense that he's giving us here. The weight of unbelief. But what does unbelief lead us to? Sin. Because in essence, that's what unbelief is, and that's what sin is. You can't separate them. Without faith, the same book has already told us, it's impossible to please God. So anything that's not faith, we also have that stated clearly, is sin. Whatsoever is not of faith is sin. So if you're depending on yourself, if you're pompously saying, God must need me, or if you're on the other end of that spectrum and saying, I'm so lowly, I'm so worthless, God couldn't use me, either one of those is a weight. Either one of those is a sinful, unbelieving weight that will keep you from doing what? Running the race. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. What is the race that is set before us? The race that is set before us is not anything new. It's not anything different from what those folks mentioned in Hebrews 11 went through, or the apostles, or the first century Christians. The details may be different. As we know, here in America, so far, we're not going through what the people in Myanmar are going through. We're not suffering in that way, the way the people in India are suffering, and so many other places around the world for their faith. But the race itself is a race it's a patient race, which is an interesting word there. He says it's a patient wait race. And I've used the example before of what this word means, patience. To us, it means I'll sit around and wait. I'm okay with that. I can wait. And, sometimes that's good. Sometimes that is important. That kind of patience, wait for God to do something, that can be good. But that's not really what he's talking about here. Patience here is a word that gets translated in the King James Bible that way. That comes from a Greek word. It's hupomeno. It's a combination word, and it means to bear up under a load. It has nothing to do with sitting still whatsoever. It has to do with continuing, moving forward, doing what needs to be done in a patient manner. Yes, in a steadfast manner, in a persevering manner, bearing up under whatever load you are given. Now we're shaking off some weight. Okay, the verse has already told us we need to lay aside some weight, right? It's not talking here about running the race with our sin weighing us down, whether it's the sin of unbelief on the one hand, or the sin of personal individual belief in yourself on the other hand. Whichever sin that is, whatever sin it is, those things are weights that slow us down. But there is a weight, there is a burden, there is a trial that is normal to the Christian experience. And some experience it in heavier ways than others, based on God's perfect will, and based on, I'm sure, his knowledge of what you and I need, and based on what he knows we'll be able to do because of how much faith we'll accept from him. And that burden is our patient running the race. We bear up under the burden. We do not stop. I've given the example, and some of you might not have been here, but when we lived in the Azores too, there were donkeys. We talked about donkeys in Sunday school this morning. I've had quite a few dealings with donkeys, all right? And none of them talk to me in human talk. I speak donkey pretty well too. I'm fluent in cow, dog, donkey, a few things. I'm a polyglot. But the donkeys didn't speak any language that I understood, no Portuguese or English or anything like that. But I would see sometimes, we would see sometimes a pile of sticks walking down the road. And it was a very odd thing to see. That's all you could see, was a pile of sticks walking down the road. And at first we didn't know what was going on, but in my curiosity, I went and searched it out and figured out what was going on. And sure enough, underneath there was a donkey that, if it could have talked, probably would have said, get these sticks off of me. But it didn't talk. In fact, it just kept walking patiently, one step at a time, running its race, if you want to mix the metaphor there a little bit, but not running, but moving, bearing up under its burden. It had been taken out away from its home, burdened, and pointed in the right direction, and it would step, one step, one step, one step, until it reached its final destination, which was home. And I find that such a beautiful picture of what the Bible talks about as patience. We don't have to be speed demons. We don't have to be super Christians. We don't have to be anything special. We just are admonished to run the race patiently. Bear up under whatever comes along. Yours may never become as bad as someone else's. Well, hopefully, God willing, we'll never be attacked for being Christians physically in this country. But it could happen. But those who do, they have their burden, and we have ours. And we can do one of two things. We can bear up under it, or we can allow it to crush us. The difference is one simple word, faith. It's as simple as that. Again, nothing that we work up, nothing that we become more, but we cease to work against what God would do in our lives. We cease to fight against him. And we say, God, whatever you bring, I know that you'll give me the strength to bear up under it. And by your grace and in your power, God, if you'll help me, I'll just keep taking one more step. one more step, until I reach home. Now, for us, the burden varies off and on. We get more on, we get less. Things change throughout life. Of course, for everyone, it's that way. But the reality and the command remains the same. Run the race, patience that is set before us. And we're not left then, we're not left alone. In our works that we must do, those things that we see in chapter 11, the works that we see that are a part of our faith, because works will manifest itself in faith, as we see that, Jesus is greater than that, but Jesus is also greater than any other power. So when we begin to look for strength for this race and for this patience, for this bearing up, where do we look? The chapter 12 here, verse 2, tells us the one who is greater than any other power, looking unto Jesus. Oh my. Folks, if we didn't ever remember anything else that the Bible says to us as believers, this should be our mantra. This should be the thing that is in our minds at all times. Looking unto Jesus. We talked in Sunday school about the brazen serpent and how Jesus referred to that when he said, "So shall the Son of Man be lifted up. And if I be lifted up, I will draw men unto me." Look unto Jesus. We had all these other examples. We've had a great cloud of witnesses to help us understand how this fleshes out, how this works in humanity. We see that. We see how people have borne up under a lot of trials and difficulties, and they've kept going and they've run the race. They've fallen and they've gotten back up, and they've fallen again and they've gotten back up. We see that in this great cloud of witnesses, but there is one example who has never fallen, who has never failed in running the race that God set before him. Looking unto Jesus, the Bible tells us here, the author and finisher of our faith. What are we talking about here? The word author, we think of someone who writes a book or something like that as a rule. And it can mean that as well. And in this sense, we have here in the author and the finisher, we have the concept, I believe, of the Alpha and the Omega, the I Am, the one who is always. He's the beginning. He's the end. We find him in the book of Revelation spoken of that way again. The great I Am who always is. But the word here also has a kind of a secondary meaning to it. It also has the idea of a captain, of someone who's leading, someone who is a prince before the people, that kind of thing. Acts chapter 3 talks about that when Stephen was preaching over there, and he talks to them and he says, You killed the prince of life. That's the same word as we have here, author. That's the concept. The prince of life whom God hath raised from the dead, whereof we are witnesses. I'm sorry, Peter. In the sermon there, he preaches this and he uses the same Greek word that we have here of author. The prince, and then he adds the prince of life. Looking unto Jesus, the author of what? Of life. The one who is the captain of life. The one who is in charge of all life. The one who has the keys to death and hell. The one who has the keys to life and death. The one who gives spiritual life through his Spirit. We have him to look to. And it also says he's the finisher. And that's a word that comes up a lot in the New Testament. Although exactly here in this form, it does not. But it's the idea still of perfection, or in the sense of bringing something to full maturity. We've talked about this word a number of times. You get mature, you get perfect, used quite a few times in the New Testament, in the King James especially. That idea of perfect doesn't mean what we normally think of, not necessarily of sinlessness or something like that, although of course Christ is sinless. But in this case, what he does will become mature. It will be full. We read this morning in our Bible reading, Philippians chapter 1. Turn over there again. Let's just take another look through some of what we read there. Philippians chapter 1. This is another one of those passages of Scripture that's just so great for us to hold on to. Paul thanking God for remembering these folks that he's writing to, the church at Philippi. And he says now in verse 6, being confident of this very thing, that he, which hath begun a good work in you, will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. The author, the one who began the work of salvation, will not fail. He will not falter until he completes, until he perfects, until he brings to full maturity his work of salvation. That's all going to come. We've talked all about the sanctification process, from positionally sanctified to progressing through this life. And one day it'll all culminate in the presence of God and His Son, Jesus Christ, as we are perfected, as we are matured by the author and finisher of our faith. If you have any doubts about what Hebrews is talking about and the rest of the Bible is talking about when it talks about faith and what the source of faith is, whether it's something we just work up within us, oh, I'm going to believe more. That verse right there, and these verses should tell you, the one who gives us the faith from beginning, authors it, to the end, perfects it, finishes it, is the one to whom we must be looking. He is the author and the finisher of our faith. In verse 3, he says, consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest he be wearied and faint in your minds. Obviously, we understand that Jesus was taken by the hands of sinners, and if you've read much commentary or sermons from the past, you'll know a fellow by the name of Jonathan Edwards, a preacher of the Revolutionary War time, really in that era of things, who preached in the Americas a simple message, really. And he was not a great orator. He was not a great speaker. He actually read his message written out. And folks who wrote about him preaching that sermon in future years would talk about how calm he was as he read it, how mild his speech was. He wasn't like me up here, all big mouth and bleh, you know. He was a very meek person, apparently, even in his speech. And you know, I have to talk loud a lot of times because some people fall asleep in church, and I have to get their attention. So you know, that's kind of what I do. He didn't do that. Apparently, nobody fell asleep though on him. He preached a sermon called "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God," and talked about the wrath of God. Someone down later did a sermon that kind of turned it around too, and wanted to preach on the cross, and they put it this way: God in the hands of angry sinners. Both things are true, and both things are so important for our understanding of what the Bible is teaching us about this one to whom we are to look. He says, consider him. Look at him. Now consider him. That's a deeper word. It goes from just a glance. It goes from just I know about Jesus, to a moment of reflection and a moment of investigation, a moment of study, a depth of trying to understand who this man is. Who is this one who's the author and finisher of our faith? He said, consider him. Consider this one. Consider what he went through, how he suffered, what he suffered, why he suffered. Who, for the joy, he says here, that was set before him, endured the cross. He said back in verse 2, this one that we're to look to endured. We know he endured the cross. We know he did. But here we have words to say, for the joy that was set before him. Does that make any sense to our minds? Maybe not on a surface reading, right? Joy going to the cross. But see, here's the thing. He's God. His thinking's a lot different than ours, isn't it? And he's seeing the joy of the results of what he would do. Certainly would not enjoy what he had to endure on the cross, what he had to endure by taking my sin and your sin upon himself when he died on the cross. Certainly not anything to be joyous of in and of itself. We are told ourselves to rejoice in all things, to give thanks in all things, to rejoice always. But it doesn't mean that everything that happens is joyful, does it? It doesn't mean that I look at something that's really horrible and think, wow, that's wonderful. I can't do that. I just can't change things around that way. But I can give thanks that there is a God. I can give thanks that there is a man, Jesus Christ, who was lifted up on a cross, who did die in my place, who's still with me as the author and the finisher of my faith, whatever I go through, whether it's joyous or not, he is there. I must look to him, I must contemplate him, and I can rejoice that he is still there, no matter what I go through. That's the point. I'm not going to tell you that I take joy in my suffering. That sounds really religious, doesn't it? Sounds really spiritual. You know? There are people who seem to think that that's the way it goes, that we must rejoice that God is causing us to suffer. Maybe in a sense. Maybe in a sense. But I think you're a little weird if you think it's fun. You know, if you can actually take joy in the actual trial itself. But if you look as Jesus did, if you look through his eyes and you contemplate what he did, what will you see? You'll see how God is molding you through it. You'll see the results that can come from it as God takes you through those things and teaches you and matures you. The author of your faith matures you until one of these days, the day of Jesus Christ comes, and you'll be perfectly perfected forever. Jesus is the only one. He's the only power that is capable of doing that. And he tells them, these people, now we know this was a time of persecution, generally speaking. This was a time almost certainly just before the, or shortly before the fall of Jerusalem. We know that in 70 AD, a Roman general by the name of Titus came in, wiped out Jerusalem, destroyed the temple and everything, defrauded the temple, he defiled the temple, all kinds of nasty stuff. It was bad. This is apparently before that time. There's talk of sacrifice and those sorts of things that make us think that this was written somewhere before the temple sacrifices were actually done away with. So yet we know that in that early time, even before that crash came down and the whole city of Jerusalem is destroyed, we know that there was persecution, do we not? We saw it right from the beginning. Right from shortly after the day of Pentecost, we see someone named Saul breathing fire against those who would call themselves Christians. We see him throwing them into jail. We see people are being killed for their faith. We see the believers spread out all across that area and beyond, fearing for their lives and yet still taking the glorious message with them. If there ever was an example of looking to the joy beyond the circumstance, that was one of them. As they got to these places, because they're being persecuted, they still preached, hey, I'm running away from something, but I want to let you know that I'm not alone. He's still with me. He's still with me. And they told others of their faith, and other people came to know Christ through all of that. So here we have one who is has done that, and he tells these people, but in verse 4, ye have not resisted unto blood, striving against sin. That has been a rebuking statement to me, except for I have to pull myself back from allowing it to rebuke me. It's like, I should be tried harder. I should go through more suffering, and that way I'll be a stronger Christian and all these things will happen. Well, you know what? God knows what I can take, for one thing. And God knows what I should have. And I have to trust him. I'm not going to go out and try to look for persecution. I'm just not going to do that. You know, I'm not just going to go out and say, hey, I'm a Christian and you're going to hell and, you know, that kind of thing. I might tell someone they're going to hell. I never would tell anyone they're going to hell because I'm not the one that judges that. But I might tell someone, hey, if you don't turn your life around, if you don't give yourself to Christ, you know, I might say those kinds of things. But you got to be a little tactful about it, right? You got to be a little wise about how you do those things. I'm not looking to go out there and just get punched for no reason. That doesn't make any sense. It's not very productive. But I know people who seem to act that way, you know. And he's telling these people, look, maybe they were complaining a bit. I don't know. You know, maybe there was some doubt about whether or not they were okay. You know, he said, look, as bad as it is, you haven't resisted to blood yet. You haven't been beaten. You haven't been killed for your faith. Evidently, the ones he's talking to. And he says, Verse 5, you've forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children. My son, despise not now the chastening of the Lord, nor faint thou when thou art rebuked of him. In other words, they're going through something. And it's fairly prophetic, actually, when he says you have not yet resisted unto blood, because a number of these people would probably end up martyred. And as we're writing to people who are Hebrews, Jewish people here, the concept of the city of Jerusalem is in mind. The sacrifices are in mind. He probably is talking at least in part to people who are there. And the destruction is coming, and people are going to be slaughtered. Maybe some of the folks, probably some of the folks reading this letter, are going to have to go through that for their faith in Jesus Christ. But he says it hasn't happened yet. And I know you're having some problems. I know. I understand. But you've forgotten something. What a thing for us to remember, that we've forgotten something. This exhortation. Let's read down through it a little bit more here. Verse 6, for whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. If you endure chastening, God dealeth with you sons. For what son is he whom the Father chastiseth not? I cannot tell you in probably any circumstance when it is that God is chastising you and when it is just a normal trial that you must go through, because that's what happens. I can't tell you those things. I can't you come to me and say, I'm going through this. Is God chastising me? I can't tell you that. In my experience, and from what I understand from Scripture, I think when it happens to me, I usually know about it. I can usually make that distinction in my own life. I can look at something that's happening, and if there's a clear connection to some sin in my life, I may want to deny it, I may want to run from it, but I usually know. That's the Lord chastising me. Now, we don't need to go looking for that either. We don't need to assume that everything that happens to us is that. God forbid that we do that. We'll run around afraid of God in the wrong way. Not in this awesome respect of God, but in the sense of, if I do anything wrong, God's going to... There are times when we're off the path as sheep, as his sheep, and he corrects us, and he may correct you completely differently than he corrects me. But if you're his sheep and you need it, you'll be corrected. And as I said, don't come ask me, is this punishment from God? Is this correction from God? I probably can't answer it for you. But if you search your own heart, you can probably figure it out. You can probably figure it out. My dear wife would ask sometimes, could this be a punishment from God? And I would tell her, I can't believe that it would be. I don't believe God would do that. But that's between you and God. I mean, but I can't believe that, no. And I don't believe that. There are trials like that. Was God chastising me for something by taking my... I don't know. I don't think so. Again, I'm not going to assume it is unless I really believe it is. Did it help me focus on certain things better? Sure. Did it point me in some certain directions? Absolutely. Did it give me a sense of how to be more compassionate for certain other people? Absolutely. Was I lacking in some of that? Maybe. I think I was in some cases. But I don't think it was necessarily chastisement. I think it was more just growth that comes through whatever trial happens to us. As we bear up under it, and we just keep going, saying, God, I need your strength to do this, because on my own, I know I can't do it. We're going to stop this morning at this point. And this chapter continues on with a lot of the same kind of thought, and it develops it and deepens it. So you take the time and go through the rest of the chapter yourself. And we will address chapter 13, God willing, next week in my last message here before you, so that you're not shocked by what happens. When I come next week, I will have a trailer on the back of my car and everything loaded up is the plan. So that, excuse me, when the service is over, I'm out of here. Headed south. It's not because I hate you or I'm trying to run away from you. It's just a timing thing. It's going to work out really well for me to be able to just go ahead and move on at that point. So That's one of the reasons why I think they've scheduled this shindig here for today, is that I will be taking off. But I'm not going to run out and not say goodbye or anything like that. Don't feel like that. But I want you to know that that's happening so that you're prepared. And when you see the trailer out there, you probably kind of go, if you didn't know. But that's what's happening. It's time for me to move on. I'm convinced still that that's the Lord's will for me. And I don't understand it all. There's a lot of things I don't understand a lot of times. But I do believe that this is the Lord's will, and I appreciate your understanding of it. And as I say, so next week, we will look at chapter 13. And I believe I see the Lord's hand in the message that he's given me out of chapter 13 as being my final message here with you. So I hope that you'll be able to be here for that as well. So let's sing our final song. What number is it, please?